Guardian Unlimited.
I call the moon my home for 3 days of my life, and I'm here to tell you about it. That's science fiction.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
And it was a bold move. It had some risky aspects to it, but it was a time when we made bold moves.
I'm Alok Jha. This is Science Extra from Guardian Unlimited. Chris Riley and Duncan Kopp are the producers of the new film In the Shadow of the Moon, a documentary about the Apollo space missions as told by the astronauts who flew to the moon. Chris and Duncan came into the pod to tell the Science Weekly team more about what went into making their extraordinary film. Asking the questions with me are James Randerson, Bobby Johnson, and one of the Guardian's film buffs, Stuart O'Connor. Chris, do you want to just take us back to the early 1960s when Kennedy issued the Apollo challenge? Can you set the scene? What was at stake then?
Well, it really goes back to 1957, of course, when Sputnik went up. It was the International Geophysical Year, and it was well known that a couple of the superpowers were looking for scientific purposes to launch a satellite into space, to get a projectile going fast enough that it could break out of the Earth's gravity and into an orbit. It's easy to forget, actually, that in the years before then, there'd been many attempts that had got into space. There were many objects that had gone thousands of miles up above the Earth's atmosphere, but they'd not made it into orbit. So 1957 is that big moment where the Russians managed to create a rocket powerful enough to hurl, albeit something quite small, physically into orbit around the Earth. It was a huge breakthrough. The common perception is that with Sputnik, everybody was in absolute terror. They were mortified across America that, of course, the next thing would be a nuclear bomb that was going to drop somewhere on Ohio or wherever. But a lot of people actually celebrated the fact that this was an incredible achievement for humankind. But the fact was that America was behind with their rocket lifting capabilities.
So their pride was dented.
And yeah, you can certainly say that it was. And, you know, there's vox pops that were done on the street in New York at the time where everybody's very kind of critical of the administration that was there, Eisenhower's administration, that they'd somehow let everybody down. And so it was a catch-up job. And in fact, Eisenhower commissioned the Saturn V the Saturn rocket program to get going at that point so that they maybe had a chance to catch up and even overtake the Russians in the early 60s. And then, of course, Kennedy comes to power in 1960-61. And frankly, everyone at NASA's not sure whether he's going to cancel the program, which he might have done as a Democrat, or kick-started even further. And in fact, they set up a committee that works out whether they can actually go to the moon in 1960. And they come up with the conclusion that they might just be able to do it in about 10 years, by the early 70s. And they show that to Kennedy. And Kennedy, as history now tells us, you know, threw his name behind it and made that famous speech.
He made this famous challenge that America had to get to the moon by the end of the decade. And Duncan, take us through at that point. This is where the film begins. This is where In the Shadow of the Moon begins, with that challenge. Duncan, take us through how dangerous it was that anyone would even consider sending a person to space at that point.
I think at the beginning, a lot of the astronauts thought it was madness, actually. I know Jim Lovell very eloquently says at the beginning of the film, he thought it was a very short way to have a quick way to have a short career, I think he says. And when you think about what was going on in those days, rocket reliability still left a lot to be desired. They were testing really souped up intercontinental ballistic missiles, and they were having real problems with them.
Well, there was a wonderful sequence at the beginning of the film where you just had 4 minutes of rockets blowing up.
Yeah, and we could have had a much longer sequence, actually, because there's plenty of footage of those early rockets having difficulties. But one thing that needs to be borne out is Kennedy knew a little bit more than he was actually letting on to, because there were quite a large group of scientists who were already looking at lifting bodies and rockets to the moon, in fact. The Army were interested at the time. And when NASA was formed, a lot of those scientists, including Dr. von Braun, the famous German scientist who had actually come over to the US, he brought his team over to Huntsville in Alabama, and he was doing a lot of research there for heavy lifting bodies. So Kennedy knew about ideas that were on paper. So I think he was quite cunning. I think he actually knew a little bit more than he was letting on to. The other thing that spurred Kennedy on was, of course, just before he gives his speech to Congress in May 61, the Russians put Yuri Gagarin in space. And he called a meeting at the Oval Office to get his chiefs in, including people from the newly formed National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. And he gets them around the table and he says, you know, what are we going to do? What can I possibly do? What can we do that's going to put us back on the map? Is it sending people beyond the moon? Could we go to Mars? Well, you know, that's not possible. He's convinced by the team that the way to go forward is to go to the moon. And that's, I think, where he lays down the challenge. And then the race is on.
And so the Apollo program is born. Now, Chris and Duncan, you both went to NASA and looked through, I don't know how many hours of archived footage from that time. I mean, a lot of the images from that time are very famous. Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, things floating about in space and so on. How much footage did you look through?
Well, the archive at NASA, the film archive, that is, and we've got to be very thankful that it happened in the 60s, frankly, because if this had happened in the 70s, a lot of it would have been shot on crappy old videotape, and it wouldn't have transferred quite so well sort of 30, 40 years on to high definition. But thankfully, it happened in the 60s. Videotape was a few years on from that, so it was all still shot on film. So NASA meticulously filmed all the development and all the training of the astronauts and every single nut and bolt that was put together and tested for Apollo on the ground. And that film archive is about 10,000 rolls of film spanning late 1950s through to early 1970s. And Duncan and I went over to the Johnson Space Center in Houston, and I'd worked with this archive a little bit before, but I never had the opportunity to kind of go through the whole blooming lot. And so on paper, I went through all 10,000 rolls, and then Duncan came out and joined me. We went through about the best 1,000 rolls of film that we could find on paper, and then transferred probably about the best 100 rolls from that 1,000 that we looked through. Now, in addition to that, there was a priceless collection of about 20 hours of material that was actually shot in space or on the surface of the moon or in orbit. When that film came back in the late 60s and early 70s, it was put under liquid nitrogen in cold storage in Houston. And that was where it was kind of kept, and it was in pristine condition. And over the last four decades, it's been brought out about three or four times, and then new transfers have been made. And just as we were starting this film, HD, high-definition videotape, was just sort of coming of age. So NASA pulled out this film for one of only four times and transferred it again onto high-definition tape. And they're the tapes that we were able to use. And it's beautifully sharp and clear. And these images that we're so used to seeing of Armstrong on the moon, really iconic images of the Saturn V launching and stuff like that, that are slightly fuzzy. And we've seen them and grown up with them. And it was like suddenly lifting a kind of veiled curtain and a net curtain and suddenly seeing this stuff really sharp and clear for the first time. And that was really wonderful.
Duncan.
We must have looked at something like 75 miles of film. I'll give you an idea of where we were working. It was sort of a big vault tucked away in the middle of nowhere, totally dark, overzealous air conditioning. So it was absolutely freezing in there. You'd walk from the hotel to NASA, and of course, you know, Houston's a hot place. It was about 90 degrees. You'd get down to the vaults where the aircon was on, and it would be what felt like sort of, you know, mid-30s to me. And you'd spend the whole day just trawling through the film. But there's something really exciting about doing that in a very odd way, because I think a lot of that material and a lot of those tins hadn't been opened in 40 years. So you take out a canister, you open it up, you see the film, you put it on, and you start in a very sort of voyeuristic way looking back in time and seeing the astronauts as they were, and not just the astronauts, but people working. It gives you a really good window into what life was like, I think, back in the 60s. And we tried to put some of that into the film. I should say that all the film is mute. There's no sound. So it's quite an odd experience just observing what's going on. But you sort of grow to love it, actually, I think, in a strange way.
James, you've got a question.
I think people may be quite surprised that it fell to a British documentary team to make this film, if you like. It seems surprising that the Americans hadn't thought of celebrating this achievement earlier. How did it sort of come about? How did you know about the archive, and why haven't other people trawled it already?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, this archive has been sitting there since it was sort of shot in the 60s. And thankfully, at NASA, a lot of people who work there stay for a very long time, and they kind of consider it their own. And so every time some manager says, hey, isn't it time we threw all that rubbish film out, they'll say, well, no, actually, it's quite valuable. Let's just keep it for a few more years here. And so that had gone on. And occasionally, filmmakers had sort of phoned them up and said, oh, what have you got on this mission or that mission? But frankly, most of the archive, that the highlights of it had been transferred onto videotape in the early 1970s. And then every time a filmmaker phoned up after that, a documentary maker, and they said, oh, we're doing something on Apollo, they'd send them a copy or a copy of a copy of a copy by the 80s. Of this one videotape of highlights of Apollo. And unless you phoned exactly the right person at NASA and said, oh, you don't happen to have any other film, or where did this film come from, you just assumed that that was it and that was all that they had. And thankfully, on other projects, I'd been there physically over the years, and I got to know a handful of these old-timers who told me about their archive, and I managed just to get in, and it was just a word-of-mouth thing, really.
It's T-minus 1 hour, 29 minutes and 53 seconds and counting.
I had the feeling the whole world was watching us.
30 seconds and counting. Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds.
Not only do I have a lot of things I can do wrong, but the consequences, should I do them wrong, are going to be immediately obvious to 3 billion people.
We went into darkness after being in daylight the whole time, and we're in the shadow of the moon.
Let's move on to the actual interviews with the astronauts as well. Mike Collins of Apollo 11, who he was the guy that they left orbiting the moon while Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin sort of had their fun down on the surface. He's definitely the star for me. I mean, I don't know about anyone else who's watched it here, but just funny and kind of wry. In the interviews, did you find that these guys had massive egos? They're 8 people who've walked on the moon. The 6 billion of us now. And they're something special. I mean, they had every right to have massive egos, but they came across as funny and kind of nice, actually.
Yes. To answer your question, the simple answer is no. None of them had an ego. Not one of them. They were all very kind of humble and modest about their kind of place in history. However, they were an extremely competitive group of people. And so they all sort of had an ego in that respect, in that, you know, they wanted to be on the next flight. And if that meant sort of schmoozing the head teacher, as it were, the Deke Slayton, the guy who sort of picked them for each mission, then that's what they do. And there was sort of no holds barred in that respect in trying to get on a mission. But it was Duncan's idea to interview Mike Collins, actually. And Duncan, you were really keen from very early on to get a command module pilot, weren't you?
Yeah, I think the thing about Mike is he wrote actually a fantastic... He's written a couple of really good books, and I read one of his books when I was a kid, actually, called Flying to the Moon and Other Strange Places. And he's just such a great raconteur. From my point of view, originally we were going to have quite an elite club. It was just going to be people who had walked on the lunar surface. But I thought we were missing a trick by not having somebody who was left in lunar orbit while the other two chaps went down to the surface and actually landed on the moon. So I was always quite keen to get a command module pilot in the film. And thankfully, we were incredibly fortunate, I think, to get Mike, because, as you say, I think he's just a great raconteur, and just instantly the audience seemed to warm to him.
The thing I will say about the interviews, though, which is quite important, is that you can't phone up an Apollo astronaut to have a long chat to them on the phone before you go and interview them. You have to prepare meticulously, almost without any contact. And Duncan set up, you know, all the interviews and the times and the logistics, often with their assistants or their partners. And then it was my job to try and gather together the entire body of knowledge that exists out there on each one of these people. And we prepared 100-page dossiers on each of these men over the months before we interviewed them. And I read every single book I could find that anybody had ever written on any of them. I watched every documentary that's ever been made that I could lay my hands on, every radio interview we transcribed. Every website we went and trawled for information. And we created these huge books, effectively, on each one of them. And that's how we prepared for these interviews. And when we sat down with Mike, we were just extremely well prepared. We never met him before. We had dinner with him, actually, the night before. And then we sat in his home for 6 hours, and we just did that interview without stopping. And the reason that they all went so well, I think, was because we prepared incredibly well for them. And on the day we interviewed Gene Cernan, the last man to walk on the moon, it was actually his birthday, and we had lunch with him in the middle of the day. We just had one day with him. And he said, do you know, some people come and interview me and they haven't even read my book. You know, and we'd read like 100 books on him before we turned up there. And he was so impressed, actually. And I was so surprised that he was impressed. I kind of figured that you get any time with one of these precious human
Nothing
beings.
Nothing impresses them.
And, you know, and you blooming well prepare for it, but most people just don't, you know.
Interviewing astronauts can be a kind of slightly strange experience, because they've done these incredible things. They've You know, they've been up into space, they've had amazing experiences that none of us can quite imagine. And yet when you talk to them about it, they're often very, very matter-of-fact about it. They almost describe it as, you know, well, I'm just doing my job and this happened and that happened. I think because they are such kind of controlled people that they don't go crazy when they get into space because they probably press the wrong button. But with these guys, it was interesting that they did start to go into the more sort of emotional side of what it really felt like and things like that, which you don't often get out of astronauts. How did you manage to do that? Was it simply that you'd been with them for such a long period of time and you'd impressed them by proving that you really cared by reading all this material in advance?
Yes, I think that really helped, actually. I mean, where we could, we met them the night before just for a few hours and got to know them a little bit. It's very hard to sit down cold with someone and get them to be very introspective and emotional and perhaps even tearful. A few of them, you know, they teared up, actually, as they were talking to us about it. And that wasn't easy. You know, these guys have been interviewed hundreds of times over the decades and they're a bit kind of interview weary, as it were. But somehow we managed to kind of get beneath that or over it as a barrier, I think. And that was partly preparation and partly just you know, working very hard at the interviews.
Is there a sense that it's, you know, good time in their lives, that they're of an age where they're starting to look back on their careers and things like that?
Yes, I think there is. I think one of the premises of the film that we had was, in retrospect, it's 30-odd years since you've had your experience. And if you think about it, for them, it was 2 or 3 weeks. In fact, less than that. 2 weeks was the average length of an Apollo mission. So a very, very short period of time, and they've had a great deal of time to think about it. And I think on reflection, there is something about interviewing somebody who's a little bit further along in life, because there's less, they feel less inhibited. I think they can talk more openly and honestly about how they think and feel. And I think the other thing, just adding on from what Chris was saying with regards to the interviews, is if you start to talk to somebody about things that perhaps they haven't even thought about themselves for a long period of time, they actually start to enjoy the experience of reliving what they were doing. And I think the director, David Sington, said to me after the team had interviewed Alan Bean, Alan had turned around and said, you know, there were things you asked me that I haven't thought about in 40 years. And it really becomes a journey for them. That's how to get underneath the normal news interview, because when I started producing the project, it was, I'll give you 30 minutes or I'll give you an hour. And you're thinking in your mind, well, there's absolutely no way I'm going to get what I need to make a film. And I think that's why it was incredibly important that Chris and the team were very well prepared. The more prepared you are, the more you're able to transport them back and get them thinking about things perhaps that they haven't thought about for a long time, and then they really start to enjoy it and they become a totally different interview. They start to open up to you in a way that perhaps they wouldn't have thought about doing with a normal news crew. You've given them more time to think about the past. So I think it became a real sort of pleasurable experience for them.
Some of my most favourite moments in the film were the split-screen bits where you see the old footage of these fighter pilots in their 30s and so on, so young and sort of excitable about everything. And then you see them now, sort of craggy-faced, looking pretty much the same. You can see that it's the same person, but the sort of wealth of experience has sort of they've gone through in that time. Can you take us through some of your favourites, if it's even possible to describe some of your favourite bits?
There's a virtual reunion that we've got in it where we kept being kind of pushed to get them all together at some point, and actually that would have been kind of counterproductive because they're all still quite competitive, these guys, and actually if they sat in the room together they wouldn't open up in the way that we managed to get them to do on their own. So what our editor brilliantly came up with in the end was this sort of virtual reunion where, over Kennedy's speech, as that sort of kind of echoes away, you've got these slow sort of portrait shots that we shot of each of these men looking kind of into the camera or just kind of looking about the room, that we sort of shot while in between questions. And there's something that always touches me, actually, when I see that moment where you've got this gauntlet thrown down by Kennedy and then all these old men that effectively became, you know, these iconic historical characters because of what he'd said. And that, for me, always touches me, I think.
I must admit, I like the launch sequence is the best bit. It's just amazing. Charlie Duke says that they'd been warned about the shutdown on the Saturn V. The Saturn V is this 363-foot rocket that basically, is carrying, you know, millions of pounds worth of fuel, and if it explodes, it's got the energy of a 3-kiloton bomb. You've seen the rocket many times, but there's a piece in the film where they describe staging, and they followed the launch with a tracking camera. And you hear Charlie talk about staging, and you hear Gene Cernan flying through the fireball, and then you see it. And this huge fireball develops when they stage. And you've got to remember that the spacecraft is, you know, 363 foot high. So that fireball is 500, 600 feet or more. And these guys are just being flung through it at speeds greater than that of sound. You know, it's a really emotive moment for me, because you sort of think they're riding on top of this monster that's on the brink of being out of control. And it must have been an incredible experience. And I think they relive that in the film particularly well. For me, anyway, I just think with the footage that Chris found, it's a very emotive moment.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The elephant in the room, if you like, throughout the whole film is Neil Armstrong. I mean, obviously, he's a central character, and the moment when he walks on the moon is one of the most electrifying moments in the film, I think. But you don't actually speak to him, and, you know, he's famously quite reclusive and doesn't like speaking about this. Did you try and get in touch with him?
Yeah, we did. We always knew that to get Neil would be a very difficult thing, because he's a very private man, and that wasn't going to stop us to begin with. And myself and the director, David Sington, we email Neil, and we had email contact, and he was very willing to help, and he had no problem with the idea of the film. But I think his overriding problem is really he likes to remain a very private man, and the idea of seeing his face sort of 12 foot high on a big screen around the United Kingdom or around the United States was something really that didn't appeal to him. I think as a filmmaker, you always have to respect that. There was this drive, oh, you know, you've got to get Neil, you've got to get Neil. Well, if Neil doesn't want to do it, even if you do get him, the likelihood is he's not going to open up in a way that perhaps the other astronauts have, because he's not going to enjoy the experience. And I think as we went on, we realised that perhaps we could not use this to our advantage, but there was another way of getting Neil into the film, and that was allowing his colleagues to talk about him, to talk about Neil in a very candid way, and I think they do. And I think it's nice that you have Alan Bean talking about Neil, or you have Mike Collins talking about Neil, so you feel that he's with you, even though he hasn't actually given an interview. It's he's got this sort of presence throughout the film, which I think works quite well.
I think it's quite nice the way he's the only astronaut who stays young.
Exactly. I mean, there's a clip of him just before the launch of Apollo 11, and he's obviously talking about the fact that tomorrow, Apollo 11, day before launch, is going to make the first attempt, the first lunar landing. And he looks very young, and it's nice to see him then. And yeah, in some ways it helps to preserve maybe the mystique of who he is. He's not in the film, but we all know he was the first man.
Well, I can tell you the effect it had on the audience that we all, that James and I watched it in there. There was a bunch of kids sitting right behind us, sort of throwing popcorn around at the beginning, and probably thinking to themselves, God, it's Saturday, I wish I was doing something else. Yeah. This is probably some educational film, isn't it? Obviously, they saw that moment where Neil Armstrong walks onto the moon, steps onto the moon, and by then you've built up the characters, you've built up the sort of the slow-mo shots of the Saturn V going up, Duncan, that you mentioned. And that moment when he walks onto the moon and says those immortal words that we know in our sleep, we've heard it so many times and they've been misused so many times. But in that context, you see it as people must have seen it in 1969 when it first happened. And literally, I had a lump in my throat, turned around, these kids were on the edge of their seat, mouth hanging open. I was thinking, that's drama. Now that's real narrative, that's real emotion. And I'm certain that every one of those sort of walked out of that theatre sort of with a spring in their step, thinking, I'm going to be the next astronaut, except that you can't be a British astronaut, can you? So anyway, moving on slightly, did the astronauts talk about modern space activities after Apollo, 1969 and then the early 70s? I mean, NASA just sort of nosedived a little bit, didn't it? The space station, space shuttle was kind of a success. Did they have things to say about those?
Well, a little bit. I mean, they're all a bit dismayed. I mean, you take Gene Cernan, the last man to walk on the moon in 1972, and he can't believe he's still the last man to walk on the moon. You know, all these years on, he absolutely thought somebody would be back there at least by the 21st century. And now, you know, we're 7 years into that and it's, you know, doesn't show any signs of happening perhaps for a decade or more, you know. So they're all a bit sad about that, I think. I think James Cameron, the movie director, put it very nicely a couple of years ago when he said that we've started to see space as a destination rather than a thing to cross to get to somewhere else like it was in the days of Apollo. It's a destination, and actually simply getting into orbit, in orbit, a miraculous vehicle, a space shuttle, and then ultimately building a space station as we're doing now. And these are great and noble endeavours that, again, are kind of uniting collaborations around the world in terrific ways. It's still a kind of B-movie to the A-movie that happened in the 60s and early 70s with Apollo. And I think that's why a lot of people have become a bit disillusioned by human spaceflight, actually. And it's not got a good press at the moment.
Well, I'm loath to end this interview, but I think we have to finish on just one small point, which the film finishes on as well. It's these conspiracy theories. Stuart, you've got something to say about this.
I just found it fascinating. You're sitting there during the whole film waiting for the topic to crop up, and the credits start to roll and nothing's been said. And then all of a sudden, over the credits, these guys just put them all to bed.
Yeah, well, it was a natural question to ask them all, although I think we didn't quite know what we were going to do with the material, and we certainly didn't know how they were going to react. But we had, I think, some just fantastic reactions from the astronauts. And funnily enough, when we started cutting the film, we put some of those quotes right at the top. We were going to introduce the film with some of the quotes sort of saying, you know, this was unbelievable, nobody believes it. And that was the original idea. Didn't quite work. And then I think one day our editor, David Fairhead, was playing around and dropped them in at the end. And it was when the credits were rolling. And it was such a natural place to have them, because it just, after you've had this hopefully engaging and an amazing experience, and you feel like you've traveled with these people to the moon and back, and you're almost exhausted from traveling with them, suddenly if you hear those comments, you sort of think, that's ridiculous. How could anybody believe it's not true? Especially with their very, very engaging interviews in the archive that we used. So it just seemed a real natural place to drop them in at the end, and it always gets a really, really good laugh, I think.
It sort of treats the topic with the contempt it deserves, really, doesn't it?
No, I think you're right, and it, as Duncan says, it was a bit of a dilemma where to use them, but they were too great not to use.
Absolutely.
And the end is just the right place. They're like the outtakes.
Well, Duncan, Chris, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about your film, and congratulations again on a wonderful, wonderful film.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
That was Chris Riley and Duncan Kopp, producers of the film In the Shadow of the Moon, which is out in the UK on November the 2nd, and you really must go and see it. For more interviews like this and the very best analysis of science, the environment and technology, make sure you listen to our Science Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts.
Guardian Unlimited.